The Internet Multicasting Service presents the National Press Club Luncheon with Speaker Senator Bob Kerry.
Our guest today, you will recall, gave President Clinton his most important domestic policy victory of his first year in office. It was Senator Bob Kerry of Nebraska who cast the dramatic and crucial vote to get the president's initial budget through the Senate and the Congress in 1993. In return for that vote, the president named Senator Kerry a co-chairman of what was then a new bipartisan commission on entitlement and tax reform. The commission performed a valuable service in pointing to the fiscal dangers posed by the exploding costs of Medicare, Medicaid, and other entitlement programs. Unfortunately, its recommendations have largely been ignored so far. Senator Kerry now is vice chairman of the Senate Select Intelligence Committee and is a co-sponsor of counterterrorism legislation. We welcome any insights he can offer this afternoon on what the nation can do in the aftermath of the tragedy at Oklahoma City, which we all mourn. Senator Kerry is also chairman of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, a job made more difficult by the fact that five Democratic incumbents have decided to retire already. That means reclaiming control of the Senate for his party will be no easy task. However, Senator Kerry is accustomed to undertaking difficult challenges. He won the Congressional Medal of Honor while serving as a Navy SEAL in Vietnam. He became a millionaire by starting a restaurant and health club from scratch. In 1982, with no prior political experience, he won election as governor of one of the nation's most Republican states. And in office, he turned a large state budget deficit into a large surplus. Not many political figures do that these days. In 1988, when Democrats around the country were following presidential candidate Michael Dukakis to defeat, Bob Kerry won his first term in the United States Senate with 57% of the vote. 4 years later, he mounted a brief campaign for his party's presidential nomination, and there are those who would like him to try again. Last year, when Republicans stunned even themselves by winning control of both the House and the Senate, Senator Kerry won re-election with 55% of the vote. When the senator agreed to chair his party's senatorial campaign committee, he said, quote, "When I think the Democratic Party is wrong, I'll continue to say so," unquote. Today, he has chosen as the title of his address, quote, "Do Democrats stand for anything anymore?" unquote. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Senator Bob Kerry of Nebraska.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, it is an interesting question. Of course, every time you put a speech together, you've got to have a title, and you pressed me for a title, and so that's the one I came up with. But it is a very important question for those of us who serve in the capacity of not just political leaders, but Democratic leaders to attempt to answer. It is very relevant and instructive of the condition of the party of Jefferson and Jackson that you would actually pay for this lunch to hear me answer it. I'm here this afternoon to answer very emphatically and very enthusiastically, yes. The Democratic Party stands still for some of America's most important values, being willing to help others with acts of shared sacrifice, of service, of patriotism, of family, of faith, We stand for a government that ensures equal opportunity for every American to move up the economic ladder. We stand for continued efforts to help the poor, especially through universal public education. I'm here to say as well that Democrats must also stand for a principle that has been challenged head-on by a new political environment that emphasizes blame and destruction rather than initiative and construction when it comes to facing up to our nation's challenges. We stand for a society that does not look for someone to blame for its frustrations and problems, but looks instead for ways to shame those who believe America's better days are behind us. For Democrats, standing for something means more than simply building a list of policy options. Standing for something should be a risky business. It should entail more than participation in this latest wave of popular sentiment to amend our Constitution or change our laws. Standing for something should be an act of conscience, an act that is connected to some higher sense of purpose than political survival or popularity. It should be an act of leadership. It should be more than going with the flow of the latest political poll. And it should be more than cutting and pasting together interest groups with targeted direct mail, clever applications of technology, or promises to provide more money or benefits. Standing for something should require us to raise more than ourselves out of our chairs and our voices out of our throats. Standing for something, to paraphrase Abraham Lincoln, should involve raising a cause that will produce an effect and then fighting for that effect. Raising a cause is exactly what the Republicans did in 1994. Their cause was that the federal government, and particularly Congress, had become a problem to be solved by electing Republicans. Our response was a very weak defense of the status quo and a counterproductive effort to demonize the Republicans as extremists. The result was a catastrophic decline for my party, which had 2 years earlier been celebrating what we predicted would be an unrivaled period of legislative triumph and glory. Failure is a very bitter medicine, as I know well. It can be distasteful to give credit to anyone who has defeated you, and in this case, to the new majority in the House of Representatives. But give credit we must. The new majority, particularly in the House of Representatives, has succeeded in doing the one thing which all lovers of the United States Constitution should applaud. They've restored Congress as a powerful actor in our government. To give Republicans their due, they have cleared the stage in Congress by inviting Americans to address fundamental reforms such as tax policy, regulation, government structure, and entitlements. They are making it possible to prune the accretions of federal bureaucracies and scrape the barnacles that have formed on our great ship of state. But there's also a dark side to this political success. The constant bashing of government and the relentless assumption that forces beyond our control run our government and our lives threaten to create an America in search of enemies within rather than partners next door. It tempts Americans to assume that the hard work of building a nation is unnecessary or fruitless because an invisible enemy, a corrupt congressman, or the welfare cheat, or the greedy corporate chieftain, really runs the show. And far more than Republican tax cuts or Democratic entitlements, it is the erosion of the pioneer spirit that built America that represents the greatest threat to our children and our grandchildren. Our culture is already feeling the impact of the politics of blame. Political appeals to white male gun owners as victims of government oppression can unintentionally provide a silent refuge for right-wing extremists who believe that violence is a reasonable means to a justifiable goal. Politicians will protest this association, but they cannot hide from their own rhetoric, which made handgun waiting periods and limited changes in assault rifle ownership sound like the beginning of the end to all of our freedoms. We have all been too reluctant to voluntarily censure a rising tide of violent expression pounding wave after wave into the living rooms of American households in the form of entertainment, of news, and political commentary. And our attacks on each other, more vicious and personal with every two-year election cycle, leave a new high water mark of debris, sends this message to our youth. It's okay to do anything you need to do so long as you win the game. But the scene in Oklahoma City, for us, is a tragic consequence of an unthinking tendency towards violence turned evil in hands controlled by murderous hearts. At first, some seemed almost to hope that the perpetrators would turn out to be foreign terrorists. This would have been easier on us and would have allowed us to continue with our delusion that we weren't victimizing ourselves. The question is, can we turn back this tide of violence? Well, I pray that we will, but prayer alone's not going to get this job done. The water will continue to rise unless you and I face this hard truth. The change needs to begin with us. We will drown in our own bile unless we keep in our minds the images of the Oklahoma victims long enough to change. I wonder if any of you saw the Day of Mourning show on CNN. There was a young, beautiful, red-haired woman who had lost two sons who said, "What am I supposed to do now? Sell their clothes? What do I say when someone asks me, do I have any children?" Well, that woman's a government employee. She's the bureaucrat being bashed by talk show epithets. Keep her in mind. Let her become a martyr. And then, just maybe, we can beat this thing. Otherwise, you and I do not have enough money to hire the police that we're going to need to protect us from ourselves. America, let us wipe away the hatreds in memory of those who have become victims to hate's power to destroy. Let us not be frightened by threats that are imaginary. Let us cast aside the conspiracy theories and the notion that we are victims of our own government. What nonsense. This government is ours. And if there's something about it we do not like, then let's get about the business of changing it. Let's end this pathetic, whining complacency which blames someone other than ourselves for the life we lead. And to those on the extreme right who are so dissatisfied and angry to the point of declaring war on this government of ours, I am tempted to revive a phrase which you used a generation ago. America, love it or leave it. But I will not, because I still believe this attitude is the definition of intolerance. After the wake-up call of last November and the wake-up explosion of last week, we Democrats and all political leaders should call on Americans to do more for their country than merely complain about how bad things are. The spirit of a determined, purposeful, grateful, and respectful life and a commitment to working together to build a better nation should be the heart of a new democratic message. America, we are at a fork in the road. We either choose the difficult road and become masters of our own fate and destiny, or we continue on the wider, safer path we trod today. One way leads to greatness, the other to self-defeating ruin. We Democrats cannot content ourselves simply with not being Republicans. We must renew our commitment to building a nation, and we must raise those causes worthy of the fight. Our first cause must be to make certain that America has the strength to lead in the world. Democrats must be for trade agreements which build jobs at home, defense policies that promote stability, diplomatic efforts which resolve conflict, aid programs which extend economic development and democracy, and God forbid, military actions which defend American interests. We must tell Americans there is no such thing as a free lunch in foreign policy. To fulfill the responsibilities of world leadership to which history has selected us will require us to pay a price. This price will tempt us to turn away, but only an American who has not visited Arlington Cemetery or the Holocaust Museum or the Vietnam Memorial can think for a moment that the United States of America should turn away from our duty. To do so would be a supreme act of decadence. Democrats should call on Americans to engage in issues abroad almost as vigorously as we do at home. Not only does our hope for peace hang in the balance, but in an export economy, so do our jobs. We should emphasize as well moral leadership, because it can be as formidable as a Navy fleet, a Marine division, or a vibrant economy. Exhibits A and B are Vaclav Havel and Nelson Mandela. These two men lead with a moral message and example, not with bullets and bravado. And the world follows them. In today's world, nuclear families are a more powerful force than nuclear weapons. Whether we like it or not, we lead by example. The world notes our low voter turnouts, political corruption, citizen apathy, and congressional gridlock on the deficit. They diminish the United States' efforts to support democracy, the rule of law, and free market capitalism. Moral leadership means recognizing that proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, conventional weapons, and international terrorism are more destabilizing in a multipolar world than they were in the past. We must press hard on all fronts, and we must not be so blinded by money that our weapons and technology sales become part of the problem rather than the solution. Our second cause as Democrats must be helping the poor and the less fortunate. By helping the poor, I do not mean blind continuation of programs which at best assuage our conscience and at worst institutionalize poverty. Here again, we must discard the politics of blame. Whether it be Democrats blaming the rich for the problems of the poor, or the spectacle of Republicans blaming the poor for what they want us to believe is the plight of the rich. Democrats as well need to take care not to indulge the weaknesses of those we seek to help. As a species, we are unique in recognizing the value of work, but we are also unique in creating innovative ways to have someone else do the work for us. If we treat the poor as if they are economic victims, we're off to a bad start. Far better to encourage the poor to acquire the habits needed to generate wealth. To be clear, we are not giving enough of our time or our money to the poor in America. Our safety net is not as luxurious as it is made out to be. To be poor in America is not as easy as our great wealth might lead a visitor to presume. Democrats' greatest success will come if we focus on what the world looks like when we stand in the shoes of those who are in the workforce and who are, in fact, of the opinion that welfare is something to be avoided. Our greatest success will come if we step inside those shoes of American families who are holding down two or more jobs in order to provide food and shelter and clothing and transportation for their families. These are the American families who are watching in horror as the gap widens between their standard of living and those at the top of the economic ladder. These are the American families who do not earn enough to buy health insurance, plan for their retirement, or send their children to college. If Democrats take this view, we will see why Republicans are wrong to trust the market to do it all, and why their proposals to cut child care, educational assistance, job training, school-to-work programs, and the opposition from many of them to universal health coverage are so destructive. Solving this problem is also difficult because progress is slow. And it's difficult because the poor, especially the working poor, don't vote. That's why we politicians ponder with real money and real tax breaks to business interests and seniors who do vote while giving lip service to the most vulnerable. Once your heart is open to the condition of American children whose rates of poverty are four times higher than our industrial competitors, you enter the world of teenage pregnancy, child abuse, and governmental turf battles. To say this is a war that will never be completely won is an understatement. But to say we will not try because the solutions are not clean or easy or appreciated is to surrender the most important high ground our country must seize. The critical player in the battle against poverty brings me to the third Democratic cause: universal public education. And here, Democrats must turn to our friends, America's teachers, and say, we are willing to spend more, but we will expect more in return. We need to say to America's parents that learning begins in the home. If a child comes to school without the motivation to learn, no teacher can save that child from your neglect. And now, more than ever before, we must say to our children, in life, there is no free lunch. Either a person acquires the motive to work hard to improve their abilities, or no collective rewards will succeed. I'm here today to make the case for a larger role for the federal government in education, and not a smaller one. By larger role, I do not necessarily mean a larger federal bureaucracy. Indeed, I could make the case for a larger role even without the independent Department of Education. What is needed is a federal government with the money and the political will to leverage change that leads to real improvement at the local level. I am convinced that Americans are willing to spend more money if they get more money, get more progress for their money. That means we must focus on results as Democrats rather than litmus tests about whether a teacher has satisfied the eligibility requirements of the union. That means we must make learning relevant and exciting so that students will discipline themselves to do the work. That means we adults must value learning and discovery because children will always do as we do and not as we say. What is needed is to follow the development of performance standards at the national level with a national commitment to achieve results in every school district, rich and poor. The federal government needs to become a full partner in the venture of learning instead of a meddling regulator in the details of running local schools. Americans should not get the idea that by proposing national standards and a national commitment, I am suggesting that the solution for our educational problems lies with the government. It will require a commitment that begins at home and an understanding that educating our children is extremely hard work. It is past time for us to stop wishing our schools got better and start doing something about it. It is past time to stop ignoring what our eyes and ears tell us, and that is that every year we are losing too many of our children of all economic backgrounds to drugs, despair, and disillusionment. So what do we do? How do we move from where we are to where we hopefully want to be? We should begin by recognizing this fact. The most important learning still occurs in the home and other non-school settings. A well-motivated student will climb mountains to learn. A poorly motivated student will fail no matter how much money or technology we throw at them. For 185 days a year, our children are not in school. Even for the 180 days they are in school, the total time spent on the educational conveyor belt is about 7 hours a day, 5 days a week. I propose we focus our attention on this large block of non-school time. If our communities can get students pumped up and enthusiastic about learning when they're not in school, nothing will hold them back when they arrive at the school building. I propose offering community-wide coalitions in America a full federal partner who is prepared to put real money on the line if they are prepared to do the same, and if they are prepared to declare up front what measure of success they intend to accomplish. Community-wide coalitions would include community leaders from schools, from cities, counties, libraries, museums, law enforcement, social service agencies, and churches. We want everyone involved in the planning, everyone involved in the work, and everyone involved in the funding. I propose to put an emphasis on the deployment of educational technology. My own personal vision is that children and adults should have in their home some kind of an educational computer which enables them to do curricula-relevant work right in their living rooms. My vision would call for the state boards to set the standards to determine what curricula is relevant and then allow the private sector to produce the programming. I believe we need the private sector along with government standards so that educational graphics will be at least as attractive as and competitive and hopefully draw as well as Beavis and Butthead. I propose the federal government offer $40 billion a year for 5 years to communities to sign 5-year performance contract. It will take this kind of money to do the job. Most of this, in my judgment, we can get by reducing spending in other areas of our $1.6 trillion budget. But apropos of what I said at the beginning, I intend to raise this cause, fight for its effect, unless I can persuade Americans that we will get improvement in the quality of education by doing this. They will not allow any of us to provide the money to do it. It unquestionably will take new ideas and new kinds of efforts, but none of us as taxpayers should suffer the illusion. At some point, it's going to require us to put money on the line as well. The fourth Democratic cause is the need to increase personal and national savings. Savings is one of those rare times where the interest of the individual and the interest of the nation intersect. And it is one of those rare areas where the difficulties of acquiring the habit of saving faced by the individual mirror those faced by the nation. Again, we must make it clear at the beginning. There is no free lunch. Either the individual makes a conscious decision to defer current consumption, or there is no savings. Either Americans save enough money to keep the equipment used by workers and businesses modern, our transportation systems efficient and productive, our employees well-trained and ready to compete, and our interest rates low, or we have to continue to borrow from abroad. Today, the United States of America is the world's largest borrower. We should be the world's biggest creditor, as we were until the middle 1980s. To become a banker instead of a borrower, an investor instead of a recipient, we're going to have to learn again the value of saving our money. The most reliable way to increase national savings is through deficit reduction, another task in which we politicians like to blame rather than to build. Savings is hard precisely because the act forces us to make choices between things we'd like to have and things we know we're going to need to have in the future. There is a powerful moral dimension to the act of savings because it forces us to defer gratification and invest in the future. Not only is it good economics, but it's a good example for our children. When it comes to deficit reduction, Democrats and Republicans must join together to get this done. At the same time, Republicans cannot expect us to sign on the dotted line on a take-it-or-leave-it basis. They're going to have to give up their cherished $200 billion tax cut, just as we're going to have to yield on our cherished entitlements. On the issue of the biggest entitlement of all, federal health care programs, we Democrats must take care not to seek justifiable political revenge. As Republicans face the issue of rapid increases in federal health programs, they are reaching many of the same conclusions for which they pilloried Democrats last year. As they examine and become advocates of managed care, they're beginning to sound a little like the president they called a socialist last year for calling for the same thing. A little I told you so may be in order. What is not in order is to demagogue the issue. Controlling the cost of health care will mean real change for all Americans. The government can't do it for us. We must stop asking for subsidies we do not need and must begin participating in cost controls as individuals. Again, there's no free lunch. One of the best bumper stickers made last year by opponents of health care reform was, if you think health care is expensive now, just wait till it's free. Well, unfortunately, this is already the case, truth be known, which is not often the case. Americans who don't need to be subsidized are already being subsidized by Americans who do. A second way of increasing national savings is to reform, dare I say it, the Social Security system so that it begins to take on the characteristics of a private pension whose foundation is savings rather than consumption. Social Security is a grossly misunderstood and misrepresented program. For all the foolish rhetoric of waiting 5 or 10 years to act, you would think that a high percentage of my colleagues in the Congress are mathematically illiterate. Social Security, contrary to popular myth, is not a savings program. Indeed, it's only marginally operated as a social insurance program. Instead, Social Security is a 60-year-old commitment by those of us in the workforce to allow a fixed percentage of our wages to be taxed and paid to those who are retired. That's what it is. And I propose to redesign Social Security into a true savings program by allowing 1.5 to 2% of the 12% tax to be invested in higher yielding equities and individual Social Security retirement accounts. For younger workers, this would have the effect of providing them with a true savings account that could be used by them at retirement in exchange for a smaller payment from Social Security. A third way of increasing our national savings is to radically overhaul our tax system, to provide American households and American businesses with a powerful and reliable incentive to save. As a long-standing advocate of a steeply progressive consumption tax, as a replacement to our income tax, I am pleased and supportive of bipartisan enthusiasm to throw out the old and bring in the new. And yesterday I became an original co-sponsor of USA Tax, a proposal developed by Senator Domenici and Senator Nunn, which will replace our current old anti-savings tax law with one that is both pro-savings and pro-investment. This has been and is a short statement to make a simple and clear point. We Democrats are prepared to take a stand. Our stands for justice and equality of opportunity will continue to be the defining and most important impulse of liberal democracy. Each of the issues I have raised and mentioned to you today has something in common. Blaming somebody else won't get the job done. Not one of them will be fixed by Republicans getting the government off our backs or Democrats throwing more money at the problem. All of them require a commitment from neighbors, from communities, and from a nation to build a better future. These battles may not put us back into the majority anytime soon, but they will enable us to say with pride that when the moment came to stand for what we believe is right, our courage did not fail us. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
Do you expect any more Senate Democrats to retire after this term? And what are the odds of Democrats retaking control of the Senate in 1996? And if you can point to some specific seats, you'd answer both questions for.
What are the odds? I don't bet on bad things happening, so I don't know what the odds are. I know that there are several, both Democrats and Republicans, that have indicated that they have not yet made up their mind as to whether or not they'll run. I can't forecast our chances for recapturing the majority in either the Senate or the House. I've said, at the time that I accepted this job from Leader Daschle, that I do not believe that we're going to capture the majority. Indeed, we may not be qualified to recapture the majority until we've given Americans a clear sense of our purpose and what it is that we intend to do with the power that we would have if we controlled the Congress once more. So that's why I've attempted to lay before not just you, but what I intend over the course of the next 19 or 20 months to do with other Americans to say that our cause is making sure that America is strong and leading in the world. Our cause is making sure that we do all we can to help the poor, particularly the working poor, that our cause is to improve the quality of public education, and our cause is to increase the savings rate both of American households and for America as a whole, and that we are prepared as politicians to risk our political careers. We don't follow the strategy of trying to paste together interest groups to make this work. We're not trying to do whatever we have to do in order to recapture the majority. We are going to fight the battles that we believe are important, and if in winning those battles we win the majority, so much the better.
When Senator Ted Kennedy appeared at the press club earlier this year, he said that the last thing the nation needs is two Republican parties. But many Democrats sound more and more like Republicans. Is Senator Kennedy right? Or are former Democratic Senators Campbell and Shelby right?
Shelby and Campbell are darn sure right. But I don't, to the right. I personally think it's a question that is interesting to somebody other than me. I'm not terribly interested in trying to figure out whether I'm sounding like a Republican or sounding like a Democrat. I'm trying to figure out what I believe this country needs to do, and then to the best of the ability that I've got, articulate that and try to fight for it. And I think if we do that, it may be that we don't recapture the majority, as I said earlier, but and it may be that there'll be some Democrats unhappy, some Democrats happy, some Republicans unhappy, some Republicans. What we have to do is to say, here's what we believe needs to be fought for, here are our causes, and then go out consistently time after time after time and demonstrate that we're willing to put our butts on the line for those things we believe in.
Tom Daschle today criticized Republicans for considering reductions in Medicare. Do Democrats make a mistake in making Medicare reform, the fastest growing entitlement, making Medicare reform a partisan issue?
Yes, we do.
Okay.
What I tried to indicate earlier was that I think Democrats should come to the Republicans and say, look, we're not going to take your budget deal on a take-it-or-leave-it basis. Here's what you have to do. Take that $200 billion tax cut and put it where the sun doesn't shine. Forget it. We got a deficit to deal with here. Number two, we are willing to work with you on a bipartisan basis on entitlements. But number three, we got to get everybody in the system. And we got 20, 30 million Americans out there working like mad night and day, sometimes two, three jobs, and they can't afford to buy health care. Now, you're telling me the market's going to fix it. Well, the market isn't going to fix it. And there's something rather arrogant and, in my judgment, hypocritical when I hear a 30-year-old snot-nosed lawyer arriving in the House of Representatives saying to me that he's against raising the minimum wage because he wants the market to do it when the market wouldn't pay him $25,000 a year. He's making 136 grand. In the House of Representatives, and he comes and says, well, let the market provide health care for those workers out there who are getting $5, $6, $7, $8 an hour. So Democrats have to come with a little fire and say to Republicans, you know, we're market-oriented too. We love free market capitalism, but there's sometimes it doesn't work. We remember what's going on out there in the street. We haven't forgotten what it's like to try to hold your family together on a relatively small amount of income.
Do you believe President Clinton has shown leadership in addressing the problem of fast rising entitlements?
No, I don't. He showed leadership in putting the commission together, and by the way, it was not in exchange for the vote. I told him that he could do it if he wanted to do it, and he did show leadership in putting that commission together, but he airbrushed it out of this year's budget for a number of reasons. And at the same time, I'm persuaded that given the fact that a president's got to choose what he's going to lead on, he just chosen not to lead on this. That's all. I don't think he's a bad president because he didn't put this on his agenda. He's got other things that are important to him. I do believe that if Senator Simpson and I, who intend to introduce legislation addressing the Social Security and retirement problems in the next week or 10 days, I hope, and we'll follow it with some efforts on health care as well. Again, to me, health care is still the driving engine of the entitlement problem. I believe if we can make the case and build a bipartisan consensus for it, I believe the president will, in the end, lead on it.
Knowing of your dedication to reducing the deficit, what is your view of proposals to drastically reduce or eliminate farm subsidies to reach that goal, and do you think those subsidies will, in the end, be reduced?
I would support reductions in the farm program payments and have in the past and will so and again to get deficit reduction accomplished. There's a longer answer to this. I think our current farm programs are not well designed and they have not been terribly well operated. And we as consumers have a fundamental decision to make. And that decision is, do we want the government of the United States of America on behalf of us to hold grain in reserve so that we don't have wild fluctuation in prices? That's what the government does. The government's made a conscious decision to hold those feed grains that are very important to us so that we don't get wild fluctuation in prices. And we recognize that once we have those inventories, that pushes the price down, and so we pay a subsidy for the farmer so they can have a chance to make a living. If we're going to downsize these farm programs, at some point I may turn all the way over and say, let's get the government all the way out of the business. Let's get the government all the way out of the business, and then consumers are going to sit and say, well, sometimes we may have higher food prices. That may happen. God still determines a lot of this stuff. Agriculture is unlike most other manufacturing businesses, and we manufacture our product out of doors. We plant in the spring, we harvest in the fall, and we pray for good weather in the meantime and bad weather in Iowa. That's what we do in Nebraska. In 87 or 88, we had back-to-back droughts, and there were an awful lot of people in early 1987 saying these surpluses are terrible. In late 1988, we're wondering, did we have enough inventory to prevent inflation and a recurrence of many of the things that we had just gotten rid of in the early 80s. So my advocacy of a farm program is not just on behalf of farmers, it's also on behalf of American consumers.
Turning to the Oklahoma City tragedy, what is your view of legislation that might be needed to both put a stop to terrorism and yet preserve and protect our civil liberties?
Well, I will say again, we don't have enough money to hire the policemen to protect ourselves from ourselves if we don't do something about our own tendency to become violent when we're in a campaign, when we're arguing with people. Drive down a highway in this town and you wonder whether or not you ought to have a loaded .38 sitting under your seat. It's tough just driving to and from work in this country anymore. So. I happen to think that some of the proposals the president's made to allow our law enforcement officers to move a little quicker are good proposals.
This has been a presentation of the National Press Club and the Internet Multicasting Service.